Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Richard Eskow, a senior fellow with the group Campaign for America's Future, who takes a critical look at President Obama's willingness to make deep cuts in social safety net programs to broker a debt ceiling budget deal with Republicans. Attorney Elliot Levitas, who discusses the $3.4 billion settlement in a case involving the claims of 500,000 Native Americans against the U.S. government mismanagement of 100 million acres of land. And author and editor Ava Golinger, who talks about the Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez's battle with cancer and the future of his Bolivarian revolution. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As pro-democracy protests roiled the Arab world earlier this year, the United States and Saudi Arabia engaged in a tense rivalry over how to respond. The Obama administration pushed for political reforms, while the Saudis have urged leaders, especially the monarchies in the Persian Gulf, to repress the protests. All during the Arab Spring, top U.S. diplomats visited Jordanian King Abdullah II on a weekly basis to push for democratic reforms as the antidote to growing public protests. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia was urging the king to hold on to his monarchy. The Saudi government also delivered $400 million in aid to the embattled Jordanian king. According to the Los Angeles Times, in May, the Saudis proposed allowing Jordan into the Gulf Cooperation Council to stimulate new investment and jobs. Saudi leaders were reported to be very upset when President Obama, after weeks of equivocation, finally called for Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak to resign. The Saudis also sent troops to Bahrain to counter pro-democracy activists. America's debate over oil dependence and climate change resurfaced as the Obama administration proposed new rules to increase mileage on cars and light trucks to over 56 miles a gallon by 2025. Predictably, the oil industry and its allies in Congress objected, maintaining that the new mileage requirement went too far and would hurt the industry by discouraging American consumers from buying new cars. White House climate advisor Heather Zischel praised the new rules proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration as a vital element in the broader framework of what we've been trying to do to make sure we have a healthy, robust domestic auto industry. According to the Washington Post, a number of top environmentalists were disappointed that Zischel failed to talk about the carbon reduction benefit in the new rules. Jonathan Lash of the World Resources Institute observed, "By excising climate change from its vocabulary, the president has surrendered a power that only he has to explain challenging issues." The Natural Resources Defense Council estimates consumers would save over $6,500 in fuel costs over the life of an average vehicle if the new mileage standard is approved. The U.S. economic recovery stalled this spring when only 18,000 jobs were created in June as the number of public sector jobs continued to shrink. The Economic Policy Institute calculates America has an overall shortage of 11 million jobs, and it could take a decade to cut unemployment to pre-recession levels. While the economy struggles, the number of teenagers working in summer jobs has fallen to its lowest level since the end of World War II. The official teen unemployment rate is over 25%, and only a quarter of teens are working short-term jobs this summer as they face growing competition from adults for entry-level retail jobs. Meanwhile, the unemployment rate for African-American teens is over 40%. The Christian Science Monitor reports that fewer job prospects for teens results in increased crime and higher rates of teenage pregnancy. Andrew Sum at the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University in Boston noted, "The more workplace experience teens have, the higher wage they'll earn when they reach the age of 20 to 25. In Louisville, Kentucky, Mayor Greg Fisher is scrambling to raise $420,000 from the private sector to fund summer jobs, a scenario that is being replicated in countless cities and towns across the U.S. this summer. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
with the clock ticking toward an August 2nd deadline to raise the current $14.3 trillion U.S. debt ceiling, White House and congressional negotiators have yet to come up with a deal to avert what most economists agree would be a disaster for the American and world economy. Last week, President Obama and GOP Speaker of the House John Boehner reached an impasse on a deal they were negotiating behind closed doors that would have reduced the federal debt by $4 trillion over 10 years. Although Obama had agreed to make substantial cuts to social safety net programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, Boehner was unable to get support from his House Republican caucus to end tax breaks for the wealthy and take away tax subsidies from profitable big businesses, including the oil industry. Obama's willingness to make unspecified cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security has angered many progressive legislators and activists who cite public opinion polls that find slashing social safety net programs are deeply unpopular. Further, those who oppose putting Medicare and Social Security on the negotiating table refer to strong majority support for higher taxes on the wealthy, corporations, and deep cuts to the Pentagon budget. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Richard Eskow, a writer and former Wall Street executive who is now a senior fellow at the group Campaign for America's Future. He talks about the disconnect between the White House and the public on how best to broker a deal with Republicans in order to prevent a catastrophic default on the U.S. debt.
The way it looks right now is that Social Security in particular was a closed issue, and that if anyone has reintroduced it, it appears to be the president. If that's the case, then progressives have good reason to be displeased with him over that course of activity. So because if he's reintroducing Social Security benefits, that's not politically wise, and it's not good policy. So the way it looks now, and I don't have the exact transcript, but he basically said in his press conference, now is the moment, let's deal with all the big issues. And if you believe that he doesn't want to cut Social Security in any way, that's an inexplicable thing to say, because you don't say, let's add a new topic into the discussion while you're holding a gun to my head. You wait till the gun is put down, and then you talk about the new topic. So progressives who are disturbed by this have reason to be disturbed and should communicate their emotions to the White House.
You've written recently about the dangers of reducing the budget deficit through a mechanism called the chain CPI benefit cut. Explain that, if you would, and how that would affect Social Security recipients today and in the future.
Well, what we're being told is that this is just a better way, this is the cover story, that this is just a better way to calculate what the real increases in the cost of living are for people on Social Security. But that's wrong. Right now, the truth is, today the cost of living increases aren't enough for older people on Social Security, because the cost of living increases today are based on what everybody in the population pays for goods and services. But old people spend a lot more on health and transportation and other items that are rising much faster than general inflation. So people are already losing benefits every year the way it's calculated now. What the chain CPI would do would be to say it's based on what people spend, not what people cost. So if I can't afford steak once a month anymore because I'm on Social Security and I'm spending less, that would lead to even more reductions in the benefit because people are spending less on food and so on and so on. So it's a way of saying the more we can't afford, the less we spend. The less we spend, the lower your benefit is going to be.
Richard, when you look at President Obama's political calculations going into these negotiations, it's kind of odd when you see the polls. Large majorities of the American people oppose cuts in Social Security and Medicare and favor a tax hike on corporations and the wealthy and a reduced budget for the Pentagon. There seems to be a decisive advantage for Obama and the Democrats to run against the Republicans who want to cut Social Security. It seems like they're signing on to the Ryan plan pretty much.
Well, I don't think they're signing on to the Ryan plan, which is absolute insanity. It's a crazy plan. It basically ends Social Security. But they're signing on to a great many cuts and austerity measures that are widely opposed, as you said, by the public and considered counterproductive, not just unnecessary, but counterproductive by a lot of very smart economists. And that's what we're struggling with. So right now, you know, we've been down for some time to two explanations, for possible explanations. The one is the president is a bad negotiator explanation, and two, this is what the president wants as an explanation. And, you know, while we can't know his mind, argument number one gets harder and harder to sustain with every passing week, it seems. So a lot of people are now asking publicly, is this what the president wants? Is the president at heart an austerity economics person who believes that entitlements and so like Social Security should be cut, Medicaid should be cut? And that's a question that people are beginning to ask publicly for the first time.
When activists are looking at the actions of the president on these negotiations, what is your advice to them in terms of the most effective way to communicate with Congress and the White House about putting Social Security and Medicare on the table, which the president has, in essence, done here? Young people, middle-aged folks, retirees all have a lot at stake here. What's the course of action that you recommend?
Well, first of all, young people most of all, because as these changes kick in over time, they'll hurt younger people more than anyone else. The stories now confirmed were that the president was planning to announce Social Security cuts in the State of the Union message, and he backed off after being deluged with emails and phone calls to Congress and to the White House. So we know that works. So first and foremost, petitions, phone calls, emails saying, if you cut Social Security or Medicare, we will be very angry with you. Those are surprisingly effective, and I would encourage people to do that every chance they get.
Now, if he goes forward with these cuts, what's the political fallout for Obama in the 2012 election and the Democrats in Congress?
Well, it's hard to believe that it would be anything but catastrophic for Democrats. The notion that somehow he could say, well, they held a gun to my head and made me do it, gets harder and harder to defend with every passing day. And even, you know, some of the senators are now saying he didn't need to put Social Security back on the table. So I think it's going to be devastating for him and for the Democratic Party if he doesn't hold the line on this issue.
That was Richard Eskow, a senior fellow with the group Campaign for America's Future. For more perspectives on the U.S. budget debate, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After 15 years of litigation, a monumental class action lawsuit regarding trust accounts for 500,000 Native Americans was settled on June 20th by Judge Thomas Francis Hogan of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. Eloise Cobell, a member of the Blackfeet tribe, was the lead plaintiff in an effort to end the abuse, mismanagement, and outright fraud that resulted from the U.S. government's control of 100 million acres of land and its natural resources that were held in trust for individual Native Americans after passage of the Dawes Act in 1887. Initially, the federal government denied all these claims, asserting it had no legal responsibility and owed nothing to the Native American litigants. Last year, the Obama administration offered to settle the lawsuit for $3.4 billion. The final settlement in the case, known as Cobell v. Salazar, will award at least $1,800 to the descendants of the original enrollees, while named plaintiffs will receive much more. Cobell accepted the deal, saying while it was not everything that was owed, she felt it was important for the Native American beneficiaries to receive some payment before more of them died in poverty. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Elliot Levitas of the Atlanta law firm Kilpatrick, Townsend & Stockton, who worked on the case for more than 10 years. He describes how the deal was reached and its importance in the annals of class action lawsuits.
Even though the trust had been in existence since about 1888 and there had been litigation over the years, this was the first time a court permitted a class action to be brought so that every individual Indian did not have to bring their own lawsuit. And that was one of the major impacts of this litigation.
And you told me that this class action would have gone forward even if it was filed after the Supreme Court decision in the Walmart case last month, you know, made filing class actions more difficult. I know Ms. Cobell received a larger payment than most beneficiaries will receive.
Ms. Cobell, who was really the moving force behind this litigation, actually contributed her own money to keep the litigation going. For example, Ms. Cobell had received one of the so-called MacArthur Genius Awards several years ago for her efforts. And if I remember correctly, I think she contributed about $390,000 of that award of $400,000 to help maintain the litigation. In a class action case, the named plaintiffs, the class representatives, those who are the leaders of the class and who actively are involved in promoting and moving the case along, are entitled to receive what are called incentive awards.
Elliot Levitas, what's the status of any possible appeal?
In a case of this sort, that is one in which the federal government is a party, after the judgment is entered, they have 60 days to file a notice of appeal. So we won't know for about another 2 months whether there will be notices of appeal filed and if those notices of appeal are actually pursued. Some members of the class have indicated that they intended to file a notice of appeal. So we will just have to wait and see until the time period has passed.
Might the government appeal, or is that not going to happen?
The government and the plaintiffs have filed a joint motion for approval, and the outcome of the approval was within the parameters that the government and the plaintiffs had agreed upon. I don't expect there will be an appeal by the government.
You've worked on this case for more than a decade. How would you sum up the resolution?
The outcome of this case is a great victory for Native Americans. And while no settlement is perfect, and this one isn't perfect, it still is a breakthrough. For the first time, the government has been held accountable to these Indian beneficiaries. And the misconduct and the mismanagement for all those decades has finally been recognized, and a redress has begun. Equally important is the fact that this decision is an opportunity for a new chapter in relationship between the United States government and the Indian trust beneficiaries, and all of the rancor of all those years and the mismanagement of these trusts, there is now the opportunity for that to come to an end.
That was Elliot Levitas, an attorney in the Native American lawsuit Cobell versus Salazar. For more information on the case, visit our website at btlonline.org. After spending several weeks in Cuba without explanation, Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez announced to his nation and the world that he's battling cancer. The outspoken socialist head of state was first treated for pelvic abscesses in Havana during an official visit to Cuba on June 20th. After initial surgery, doctors discovered and removed a cancerous tumor. The 56-year-old Chavez returned to Caracas on July 4th, quashing rumors spread by his opponents that he had died or was terminally ill. While government spokespersons report that Chavez is recovering rapidly and is now beginning a second phase of recuperation, he's been forced to reduce his activities and usual frenetic pace of public appearances. Chavez maintains that he'll be ready to compete in his nation's next presidential election in December 2012. But opponents are openly hoping that his illness will cut into the president's popularity or cause him to drop out of a re-election campaign. In legislative elections last September, Chavez's United Socialist Party, that champions social programs for the poor, won less than half of the popular vote and lost its two-thirds majority needed to pass some legislation unilaterally. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ava Golinger, a Venezuelan-American attorney, author and editor-in-chief of the English-language newspaper Correo del Orinoco Internacional. She talks about Hugo Chavez's battle with cancer and how his illness may affect the future of his Bolivarian revolution.
It was a very unexpected and surprising situation for everybody, including for President Chavez himself, when the tumor was detected. And initially, I mean, he was in Cuba. It was the last leg of a Latin American tour that he was on. He had gone to Brazil and Ecuador before that. And he had no plans of doing any kind of medical treatments beyond getting a checkup because he had had a knee injury during the month prior. And that was when, during the checkup, well, actually during his stay in Cuba and his meetings with President Raul Castro, and then with also Fidel Castro. It was really Fidel. I mean, it's kind of an amazing little story, but it was really Fidel that noticed that that Chavez was experiencing discomfort in his abdomen area. And so, basically insisted that he get a full checkup. And when that happened, they discovered this pelvic abscess and removed it immediately because that can be incredibly dangerous. It was on the verge of becoming a systematic infection, which could then lead to almost an immediate death. So that, I mean, literally his life was saved there. And after they did that surgery, which was the one that was first sort of, you know, announced to the public within hours of the surgery taking place, within 2 days, Chavez himself went on Venezuelan television via telephone, talked about the whole procedure. He was doing really well. You know, he was on the path to recovery from that initial surgery. Nothing else was alluded to whatsoever or expected. And then, as they do, doctors take tests when they're conducting surgeries for certain things that are abnormal, like a pelvic abscess. And what happened was the test came back that there were some cancer cells detected and that a malignant mass, a tumor in the pelvic area. It's not actually organ-specific. It's not colon cancer or prostate cancer or anything. And so it was immediately removed. And that's why, I mean, there were a lot of rumors, a lot of manipulation, you know, all kinds of speculation, media around the world. I mean, the government here was regularly informing on his recovery process. There was a period of silence, obviously, about the surgery for the tumor removal. That was Chavez's decision, which he, you know, took responsibility for when he revealed everything that he had gone through during his stay in Cuba and his medical treatment, and he made a speech to the nation on June 30th, actually, which was a very intense speech when he revealed that. And he himself said, you know, look, he wanted to be the one to tell the people of Venezuela what was going on with him, and not let it be left to secondary voices or media, so that there couldn't be any kind of speculation or rumor. I mean, even had like a government official said what was going on, still the media, a lot of media would have doubted it. There would have been distortion. So it was, I mean, everyone can have their own criticism or take on it. I mean, I believe there's a right to privacy there and intimacy in that it was his decision, even though he's a public figure and a head of state, but to do it that way, that's what he did. And so, after that, he's been very open and frank since his return to Venezuela on the morning, early morning, actually almost middle of the night on Monday, last Monday morning. He has been just really every day, you know, informing the public about the recovery process. So undergoing just today, someone was commenting, it's like a reality show with Chavez. Now we're seeing him doing his exercises or eating his meals with his family. You know, and a lot of that is really just to debunk the rumors going on, because even though he's back and he's in action, he's working and overseeing government and giving talks and going on TV, there are still all kinds of rumors floating around that he's terminally ill, you know, he's on his deathbed or he's not going to last long. And so that's why they're sort of going over the top to show that he's really recovering quite well.
Ava, during President Chavez's absence from Venezuela, there was a lot of discussion about his health and the future of the economic and social revolution that Chavez heads, and if he were to disappear from the scene, what would happen to that revolution? What, if anything, came out of those discussions when President Chavez's health was uncertain, and the fact that Chavez embodies and personifies the revolution to such an extent? Is there a larger organization there that will take over if and when President Chavez leaves the scene?
I think that's obviously an ongoing issue that's constantly debated and contemplated here, because Chavez is mortal and won't be around forever. And at the same time, while he does have a very strong presence and is a powerful leader, there's absolutely no denying that, and that he is the leader of this process taking place in Venezuela, of this Bolivarian revolution, that my feeling all along has been that what's happening in Venezuela is, you know, basically an awakening, a collective awakening of the people, a restructuring, well, a revolution, a transformation of the country, of every aspect of its, you know, political life, economic, cultural, educational, everything. And so there's a new generation that's grown up during the past decade under this new framework, and, you know, that has a completely different vision of the world, of their country, that cherishes now their identity, that's proud of being Venezuela, a generation proud to be Venezuelan when before most weren't proud to be Venezuelan. You know, they wanted to be from the U.S. or Europe or wherever. And this is not a process that's just being conducted by Hugo Chavez. There are millions of people here in Venezuela that are involved in the changes taking place in their country. And that's one of the things that's often neglected from a lot of media and reports, particularly internationally, is precisely the involvement of the people and the participation, the fact that really the millions of people here in Venezuela that are making things happen. You know, I mean, Chavez is the voice. He's the sort of most physical presence that people see. But it's really the people that are doing all of this, you know, right. Millions of them. And that will continue to do it when he's here and when he's not here.
That was Ava Golinger, a Venezuelan American attorney and editor-in-chief of the English-language newspaper Correo del Orinoco Internacional. She is the author of The Chavez Code, Cracking the U.S. Intervention in Venezuela. Read more about Hugo Chavez and Venezuelan politics on our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.